Okay, morning everyone. Good morning and welcome to week 5 of the series called Within You. Just to remind everyone that today is the final session. The term would have normally finished next week, but as I think I said to you, I'm going to be away next week. I'm traveling yet again. Thank God for good things. No, actually. I love being there, but I don't like traveling now. But I am going to my niece's wedding in New York, so I'm going to be away for a few days. Thank you. And so therefore, this is the last session for this year. It's gone quickly. And just to remind everyone that next year, we start again on the 6th of February. So that's the first set, 6th of February. I'm working on a topic. We'll let everyone know closer to the time. However, before that, we have every year on the 25th of December, it's on your seats, till the 1st of January, we have what's called the Summer Learning Program. It's always lots to choose from. It's in the morning. The main program is 10 a.m. to 12 noon. Two sessions, the first hour and the second hour. The first hour, there's always a bit of a choice of different topics. The first 2 days, there'll be three choices, one for men, one for women, and one for both. I'll be doing one for both on personal growth topic, as I normally do. That's the first 2 days, and then the rest of the week, there'll just be two choices. And then the second hour, there's always a lecture for everyone. The topics of the lectures will be... We have a range of speakers, as you can see on the number 3 there on the flyer, and the topics will be on the emails. So come along. You don't have to come for both sessions. You can come for one session. You don't have to come all the days. You can come for one of the days, two of the days, whatever you can make. It's always good. The main thing is it's end by 12, and you've still got a day to enjoy the summer. So that's the 25th to the 1st. Okay. So we've been working on this model, the model of two ways to discover our own self-worth or define our own self-worth. One is the outside-in model, one is the inside-out. The without model is when our worthiness comes from other people, from outside. That's a problem because the outside then creates my sense of value. The result of that normally is, as we've talked about in length, is ego, insecurity, emptiness, immediate pleasure, what's good for me now, what's good in the moment, but not anything deep with meaning and purpose, whereas the inside-out model is acknowledging our intrinsic value, right? The inner worth that creates outside reality, and the result of that is humility and the seeking of meaning and purpose, as we've talked about in great detail. Now, what we've done in the last few weeks is we've also, once we have that mindset and that philosophy, we've talked about the importance to engage in behaviors that allow us to tap into that intrinsic worth. One of them is the concept of showing up and being honest, not hiding things from people. And then we talked about the concept of self-control, showing up in two different ways, delayed gratification and the power of the space. So when we work from outside in, then if someone says something to me, I immediately impulsively reply. If I'm not defined by the other person, I'm able to stop, create a space, self-control, and measure my response so that it's effective, it's meaningful, and it's purposeful. That power of that space is very, very important, both in pleasure, in other words, the ability to delay gratification, and both in the concept of response to other people, because that allows us to tap into the part of us, the depth of us that is selfless, deep, and we focus on the inside out in the journey of trying to find meaning and purpose. Now, last week, just to summarize, we talked about more ideas that help us build that inside-out model. First thing, we spoke about freedom. We talked about the whole idea of going out of Egypt, that freedom is something that comes from within, something we talked about when we did the book on the choice, and so on and so forth. We also spoke about the concept of living intentionally. Living intentionally means bringing our values into practice from theory. But we talked about that in order to do that, that actually requires intention. It requires what we call living on purpose. In other words, not just going through the treadmill of life, but really shifting from what we call living on autopilot to living on purpose, that in every moment, in every experience, we're able to stop and create a sort of a mindfulness, create a focus, create, well, what am I doing now? Why am I doing it? What's the purpose? What's the goal? As we explained last week, that goal could just be chilling out. It could be a mindless exercise we have to do mindfully because we have a reason to do it, not just that we're out of control. So we're not shifting from thing to thing, from experience to experience, from one running to the other running. It's more about living on purpose. And only when we live on purpose are we able to tap into who we are, work inside out, understand that we have an intrinsic value, we have a spark, we have the depth of our soul, which is the aspiration to give each moment its full potential, to give each moment meaning, to give each moment purpose. Now, we explained that one of the strategies, I mean, based on the book that we're working through, one of the strategies to do that is the concept of acceptance. Now, acceptance sometimes is much harder than others, depending on what the issue is. But even in very simple things, the acceptance of every day-to-day things that kind of go wrong, where we accept the moment. Meaning, what does that mean? It doesn't mean resigning or giving up, but it does mean accepting that the now, right, this was a really important point, the now that we're experiencing is the reality. And the inside-out model is that I don't let the now on the outside define who I am, unsettle me, distract me, but rather what it does is the now is what it is. I accept that now, and now it's up to me from within to not let it control me, and to give it meaning and to give it depth, right? And we went through the three choices that he talks about in the book, that when something happens, we can not accept and get angry. We can accept but don't do anything about it. That's also not that good because that's not what life is about. That's sort of more falling victim. It's more the opposite of getting angry and doing nothing. It's also letting the outside define me. In other words, this is what it is. I can't help it, so I'm done. I'm messed for the day. That's also an outside-in model. In other words, subtly, we're also letting the outside define us, right? But the real way to do it is to accept and to work on changing it or to giving it meaning. Not always we can change it. Sometimes things happen, that's what it is, but we can try at least give it meaning. And what we explained is, and as he explains in the book, that one of the greatest tools in order to get to the level of acceptance, which, by the way, isn't an easy thing, no matter what the circumstance is, even if it's little things that go wrong in the day, acceptance is one of the hardest things to do. But it is made possible when we introduce the element of faith and the element of hashgacha pratit, meaning that everything that happens by divine orchestration, and that it's something that we cannot really control. What we can control is what we're going to do with the now, right? That doesn't exclude working on the next moment being better, or praying that it should be better, or hoping it should be better, and so on and so forth. But the now is the now, and we give it what we need to give it. So that's just a little summary of where we have to. Today, just to end off, I'm just going to take one or two other chapters in the book, which sort of more or less covers everything that's in this model, and do two things. The first thing is actually look at some other behaviors, but the opposite way around. What I mean by that is, we talked about the importance of engaging in behaviors that allow us to achieve a certain mindset and a certain feeling, right? So that was based on the model of the heart follows the action. So we develop a mindset, we have it in our mind, it's hard to feel, so we revise it in our mind all the time. But what we also do is we bypass the heart and we engage in action that allows us to behave as if we're feeling that way, and then hopefully we do feel that way. But in order to do that, we also have to identify negative behaviors. In other words, we have to identify behaviors that pull us away from that mindset, that pull us away from that feeling. Because it also works in the opposite way around. In other words, just like engaging in behaviors which are consistent with the inside-out model helps us feel the inside-out model, engaging in behaviors that take us away from the inside-out model, in other words, that are more consistent with the outside-in model, pull us that way as well in terms of who we are. So the more we engage in negative behavior, which is consistent with defining ourselves by the outside, the more we become like that, and the more difficult then it becomes to get out of that, right? That's also I've mentioned this many times, there's a concept brought down in early Jewish writings called Yedi'at HaMakah Hatzi Rufu'ah, which means knowing the disease is half the cure, right? In other words, sometimes just knowing that a particular behavior or particular experience is negative helps us identify the problem and helps us stay away from it. Not always we can, but at least it gives us a focus. So just to look at three things. In other words, basically these three things are signs that if we reflect, as we should every so often, if we reflect and we come to the conclusion that we're engaging in some of these behaviors, we should then be able to take it as like a sign that we are not free, that we're in fact enslaved. We're enslaved to the outside, right? So the first one is an obvious one, anger, right? Now, anger comes in different forms. It could come in the form of rage, as the picture says, right? And what anger is, of course, and we all engage in anger sometime along the line, because none of us are perfect. But what anger is, in terms of this discussion, anger is the opposite of acceptance. It's the exact opposite of acceptance, right? Now, I think we've explained this many times. When we talk about anger or staying away from anger, it doesn't mean never feeling angry, because that's reserved for a select few in the entire universe. We're all human beings. Things do upset us. Things set off or trigger feelings of anger, feelings of frustration, feelings of upsetness, all related feelings, and sometimes that can tempt us to actually express real anger, which is more rage, right, and temper, losing our temper. But when we engage in acceptance, acceptance is not natural for most people, right? Because we do get upset when things go wrong. But when we engage in acceptance, what we're really trying to do is we're trying to move away from anger, right? In other words, acceptance and anger are two opposites. They can't coexist. The more we work on acceptance, the more we move away from anger. If we check ourselves or we catch ourselves becoming angry a lot or expressing anger and expressing frustration and expressing stress at things that don't go the way we expect them to go, that's a sign to us that we're not doing very well in the acceptance area. We're not really accepting. Why? Because it's very simple. Why do we get angry? Because getting angry is about something on the outside of me not working properly, right? That's what anger is, essentially. So how dare you say that to me? How dare you do that to me? How come the day didn't work out the way I planned it, right? Why did this happen? Why did they say that? How could they do that? And so on and so forth. So anger really almost comes from a desire to want to manipulate the outside, which of course we can't do because we don't have control on the outside of us. But nevertheless, we want to have control. We think we can have control. And we don't. And therefore, we get frustrated and angry. And it's almost, an anger almost is like the substitute method to manipulate the outside. So sometimes we get angry at someone in order to force them to do something. So it's either frustration and not being able to control the outside, or it's a tool to try and control the outside. Either way, you can see, it's a very, very outside-in model. Why am I so obsessed with the outside? Why am I so obsessed with something that's happened around me? Because I need that to work, because I'm defining myself by that outside. Does that make sense? Yeah? So, as he puts it in the book, he says, anger can lead us to be destructive towards ourselves and to those around us. Now, we know it to be true, right? Anger is a very, very ineffective tool. And it does cause destruction. It causes negativity. It causes us unhappiness. It doesn't accomplish what it needs to accomplish. Even when it does, by the way, it's very short-term and very transient and very ineffective. And also we hurt other people, as we know. And therefore he says, we must remember to tell ourselves a simple truth. When I'm angry, I'm wrong. Right? Which is why Maimonides writes, and I think we've mentioned this in the past as well, Maimonides writes that anger is one of those things that we need to stay away from completely. Right? Anger, of course, is very different to passion. Passion is different. Passion is good. Maybe it's the good part of anger, but right, to be passionate and strong about something, that's okay. But anger means that I'm trying to manipulate, I'm trying to control, or I'm angry that I can't control. The Talmud has a very strong expression when it comes to rage, and it says that those people going to rage is like they engaging in pagan worship, which really, in the context of last week's discussion, is understandable. It doesn't mean we're actually bowing down to an idol. What it does mean is that it is an expression of lack of faith, because it means we're not accepting. It's the opposite of accepting. Opposite of accepting means that our commitment to the concept of Hashgacha Pratit, the commitment to something, to the concept that there's a plan and there's someone who's running the world, is problematic. Now, we all experience that sometimes, but that's what the Talmud means. And that's why Maimonides, although Maimonides in his writings encourages a middle path very often, and encourages balance in most of emotions, in most of behaviors, he says a bit of either extreme is never good, but when it comes to certain things, one of them being anger, he says there we have to stay away from it as much as we possibly can. All right, because it doesn't have a lot of, anger doesn't have a lot of redeeming factors. Apart from the fact that, as we've talked about in the past, that going into a rage, getting angry also is loss of control. A loss of control of ourselves, I mean. Right? We're trying to control the outside, but it's actually loss of control. People go into rage, often lose control. And loss of control is a bad thing. Because living with meaning and purpose, as we talked about last week, it's the opposite of living on purpose. It's the opposite of living intentionally. Living intentionally means we're always in control. Living intentionally means that we have a plan. We have a focus for every moment, for every experience, for every hour. It might mean to take a break. It might mean to engage in entertainment, whatever the case is. But we have a purpose in life. We have a mission. We have a focus. Losing control means we've lost focus completely. So it's like the extreme mindlessness, if you know what I'm saying, but in a very, very bad way. Now, when we engage in an inside-out model, right, then although something might be painful, but the inside-out model says it hasn't, whatever has happened hasn't defined me, I still have my intrinsic worth intact, my soul is still intact, my spark is still intact, my depth is still intact, and it's that depth and that strength and that essential being of who I am that is able to be free in any circumstance, and therefore is able to give meaning and purpose, and able to bring purpose and bring depth to any experience, right? So, incidentally, being angry doesn't mean, it's not the same as being assertive, right? So, for example, a parent is trying to sleep, a little kid gets up 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm thirsty, or gets out of bed, right? As kids tend to do. And then, when you give them a drink, then they're hungry, or... and then when they finish being hungry, there's something else. But I don't want to go to bed, right? So, different ways of responding to that. Either you agree that they are thirsty, because, I don't know, you gave salty food for supper last night or something, so maybe it's like, are hungry, so give them a drink. But let's say you're actually fed up, you actually would like to go back to sleep, right? So there's a different, I'm just giving this an example for anything in life, right? There's two ways of responding. One is getting angry, another one is just very calmly and assertively saying, go back to bed now, right? The difference between the two is one's outside and one's inside out. Getting angry means you're ruining me. In other words, it's not about you, it's about me. I'm angry. I'm frustrated because I have a plan. My plan is to be able to sleep now. You're ruining it. If I'm angry, how come I can't control? I'm going to try and control you. It's all about the outside, right? Assertively turning around and saying, no, you actually need to go back to bed now, is saying, I'm not angry. I'm calm. I'm accepting it, but I'm doing what I need to do. My value system dictates to me that you need to sleep. I need to sleep. So we both need to be in bed. Go back to bed. It's very different, right? Not getting angry doesn't mean being calm. Acceptance doesn't mean being a victim and being a schmatter, right? All it means is that we don't define ourselves by what is going on outside, and therefore I'm never frustrated. It's taking away the frustration, it's taking away the rage, it's taking away the definition of self from the outside and switching it around. And then working out what my value system dictates I should do. If my value system dictates that I need to be strong, I'll be strong. Being strong is not the same as being angry. Because being strong means it's coming from inside, it's coming from a sense of value, it's coming from strength, which also means, by the way, that it has signs. The signs of being strong from within means that it's being strong with respect, it's being strong in a measured way, it's being strong effectively, and it's being strong about what is good for the situation, what is good for the person, what is good for the outcome, rather a broadcast of what I'm feeling. Very different, right? You know, it's interesting. There's a very funny, not funny, there's a very interesting phrase in the Talmud. And it says that a person, Adam Nikar, Bishlosha Dvarim Adam Nikar. It says, with three things you can recognize the real essence of a person. And Hebrew, it sounds a lot better. I didn't translate it so well. It says, Bekoso, Bekiso, Ubekaso. Koso means with his cup. Kiso means his wallet, his pocket, essentially. Ubekaso, and his anger level, right? And the commentary explains, what is that? That's three things you can tell a person. Why? Because those are three things where you can tell how a person is operating. Is he operating from within out, from within outwards, or outside in? Right? Kosa, his cup, meaning his alcohol consumption. And the commentaries are saying that it's not a statement necessarily, I hope not at least anyways, it's not a statement ruling out alachaim, right? Because Jewish law, actually, apart if someone is really suffering from an addiction, that's different. But if you look in Jewish practice and Jewish law, there's actually quite a bit of wine consumption that goes on. There's a mitzvah to drink wine on a yontif to be happy. There's a mitzvah on Pesach night to drink four cups of wine. There's a mitzvah every Shabbos to make kiddush, right? And by the way, in the times of the Talmud, grape juice wasn't much of an invention, right? So it was always wine. In fact, if you look in the Talmud, there was quite a bit of wine drinking there around meals and about benching and havdalah. Under a chuppah, there's wine. And by a bris, there's wine. There's always wine, right? Once, I don't know if I told you this story, when I was a principal of a boys' high school in my previous career, so towards the end when I was there, we employed a deputy to help me out, a non-Jew. He was an ex-Seventh-day Adventist pastor, actually. He was a very big educator, he was a very good educator. He was a little bit frustrated with religion, but he knew a lot. Like, I used to get nervous because, you know, their sign of scholarship is actually knowing Tanakh. Truth is, we didn't learn much Tanakh in Yeshiva. We learned Talmud more than Tanakh. And he used to assume that because I'm a rabbi, I know Tanakh backwards and forwards, right? And he would quote these, what he called Old Testament, right? But so he used to quote these things and he would nod as if I know exactly what he's talking about, which I didn't actually always know what he was talking about. But that was a bit humiliating. But anyways, so before Purim, of course, is the Yontif when we sit around, we say a bit of L'chaim, we try and inspire each other, you know, in a good way. So the kids told him, Mr. Jensen, his name was, he said, you know that, you'll see the day after Purim, Rabbi Gerari is a bit tired always. So he comes to me, he says, he thinks the Jewish religion is wonderful. I said, why? He says, you know, where he comes from, Seventh-day Adventists, there's a ban on alcohol all generally. He says, that's not sustainable. You need a balance. He says, you guys have like certain times, and especially like one day a year, because the kids had explained it to him, not quite right, but... He says, this is amazing. You actually have one day a year where, like, there's a license. You can just, you know. I said, it doesn't quite work like that. Yeah, but yes, I will be a bit tired after Purim. It's true. Okay. Anyway, it's very funny. But, so the Talmud says, but you can tell a person by the way Rashi explains over there, the commentator Rashi explains what the Talmud means. You can tell a person essence of how he engages in something that's pleasurable. See, there's nothing wrong in Jewish, let's go back to what we spoke about a couple of weeks ago. In Jewish religion, nothing wrong with pleasure. In fact, we don't have the system of abstaining as an end in itself. We have fast days, we have a means to an end, we have control and so on. But God, in fact, the Talmud says that God created the world for us to enjoy. And in fact, there's a very interesting thing, I've mentioned this before, that in the Torah there's a section that deals with a Nazirite. A Nazirite is someone, in order to engage in holiness for a period of time, for a temporary period of time, the person takes upon themselves not to have grapes, not to have any wine, not to have any extract from grapes, and to grow the hair, and so on and so forth. And the Nazirite is called a person, is referred to as a person that goes through a period of holiness. And then the Torah says that when he finishes that period, there's a ritual of how you complete that period of Nazirut, it's called. And one of the things is the person had to bring a sin offering. So the Talmud says, why a sin offering? This is a person that's just gone through a program of holiness. So why a sin offering? And the sin offering is explained because he abstained completely from drinking wine. And God created wine for us to enjoy. He created his world for us to enjoy. And the Talmud says that when a person is finished on this planet, God will have a complaint almost. I gave you a world and you didn't take advantage of it, right? But at the same time, the same Talmud and the same Torah has so much written about not overindulgence. In other words, I gave you a world to enjoy, but the enjoyment itself has to be part of the process of meaning and purpose. Enjoyment itself has to be with the focus. The enjoyment itself has to bring you to a deeper life, to a richer life, to being a better person, to being a happier person, to being, right, which is the whole balance that one has to try and reach, which goes back to the delayed gratification thing we talked about last time. So therefore the Talmud says that's one of the ways you can tell a person is his cup. How does he or she engage in the cup? How is it overindulgent? Does it lead to just emptiness and going crazy, or does it lead sometimes... You know, when the Talmud says, and this is true till today, that sometimes when people sit around and they say a bit of l'chaim and country, they actually are closer to each other and they open up a little bit and it breaks down barriers and sometimes it bonds people together if it's done right. Right? If it's done wrong, then it's indulgence for the sake of indulgence. It's an outside-in model. You're taking something from the outside to give you temporary pleasure. If it's done correctly, you're actually starting from within and using something from without for the right purpose, right? So therefore, the Talmud says you can tell a person by kiso, his cup. You can also tell him from his kiso, from his pocket, his wallet. Same idea, right? God asked us to work. God asked us to earn money. God says it's okay to want to earn a good living and a decent living. But also, again, what's your purpose? What's the end goal? Is it to earn a livelihood in order to learn a livelihood and then in order to enjoy life? Or is it to bring good things, to do good things, to create the resources that God gives us by, number one, having gratitude and acknowledging that the blessings come from Him. Number two, using it for a purpose, using it for something that's going to be meaningful, helping people, giving to other people, supporting other people, and so on and so forth, right? So again, that's what the Talmud is saying. You can know a person from their pocket. And then finally, the Talmud says you can know Bekaasor from his anger. How does his anger level, right? And then the commentaries explain also, does a person get angry and lose himself, which is a sign of losing control and being defined by the outside, or does he have passion? Or does it come from the inside where he's strong? It's a strong person, but it's a passionate person, using that strength from within, using that strength from the spark we have from within in order to bring good things, again, the inside-out models. That's exactly what the Talmud is saying. You can know a person. So therefore, anger, in the negative sense, and if we reflect and we see we're getting angry a lot, it's an indication that we're not practicing the inside-out model. We might talk about it, we might think about it, but we're not actually there, right? It's moving away from anger and engaging in acceptance, which allows us to reverse that and move from within. The second, of course, is the concept of judgments, right? Judging other people. Also, very, very difficult concept because, I suppose if we're honest, at least I'm talking to myself anyways, but most of us do judge other people, right? Not to judge other people is a very, very difficult thing to do. But at the same time, it's worth reflecting and understanding where does judging other people come from? First of all, constant judgment of other people, again, is a sign of focus on the external, right? Because very often what happens is when people judge people, you always can see a problem when it's done in extreme. So people who are very judgmental are normally very not judgmental on themselves. I don't know if you've noticed that, right? In other words, it's almost a distraction from themselves and focusing on the other. In other words, it's defining my behavior, defining my experience, but what I see going wrong on the outside, rather than starting from within, right? So judgment often comes from blame. Again, it's a distraction. I'm moving away from dealing with what my issues are and what I need to change, what I need to fix, and referring that to other people. Now, of course, just to talk about judgment for a moment, and we've talked about this many times, but just to put it into this discussion, again, it's a balance. Sometimes we have to judge, but it's depending where the judging is coming from. So just like anger, just like indulgence, judging also, there's two ways. It can be judging from outside in or judging from inside out. And I think I've shared with you this formula before, that sometimes we're in a position that we have to judge, right? And I've always given you this classic example of a parent and a child. If your child does something wrong, don't judge them favorably. If they did something wrong, you need to take responsibility for it. And you need to interpret it for what it is, right? So we have this concept in Pirkei Avot in the Ethics of the Fathers where we are told to judge favorably. Judge favorably can mean lots of things, but what it often means is maybe you misinterpreted the story. Maybe you didn't actually do what you think you did, and so on and so forth. But that's okay, but not always, right? And I think, again, it's the same concept. What's my focus? What's my life built on? Is my life built on making everything around me okay in order to define me? Or is my focus coming from within and living a life based on values? If we live a life based on values, we judge much less because we're busy with ourselves. We're busy understanding our own intrinsic worth. We're not distracted or affected adversely or getting frustrated by other people. Therefore, we judge much, much less. But we work from within based on our value system. Part of that value system is that sometimes we have to judge, right? And the formula basically for that is, as we've talked about many times, it depends if the person that we're dealing with is within our circle of influence or not within our circle of influence, right? Often what we do is we do it the other way around. We protect those that are in our circle of influence, and we are very, very blind to people's shortcomings because they reflect on us a lot of times. So you have, you know, often Jewish parents who their children could do nothing wrong, or their friends could do nothing wrong, or they, right? No one here, of course, but then everyone else, we have plenty to say, right? We've got an opinion on every politician in the entire world, and every person in the entire world, and every person you read about in the entire world. We've got it all. We've got it all fixed, right? And like, you know, the old thing, people get together, and like, you know, they get together to have a bit of a coffee together. By the time they finish, they've solved all the world problems, right? Because we have an opinion. What really should be doing, should be that, oh, and we know exactly who in shul is a problem, and who in this is a problem, right? Everyone, right? Except for the people, of course, that we need to actually focus on. Same idea, because you're working outside in, not inside out. In other words, if it's outside in, we leave those people alone, because it doesn't concern us. The outside doesn't affect us. But working from a value system, the people around us does affect us, only because we have a responsibility. If we have a responsibility, then we need to be honest with people. If we have a very, very good friend, sometimes being a good friend means they're able to point out a shortcoming, right? It's part of what the Torah tells us. It's part of what helping other people is. Sometimes helping other people even means a hard conversation. Out of love, coming from love, with love, but still a difficult conversation. So that's different, right? But that's judging from within. But the outside-in model is just being a judgmental person. In other words, I'm distracted away from looking at myself and working from within, and rather letting everything else on the outside. Difficult thing, by the way, but nevertheless. And of course, the third one that he talks about in the book is the idea of guilt, which we talked about many, many times. And here again, same thing, there's a difference between good guilt and bad guilt, right? Most guilt is bad, actually, right? But again, bad guilt is exactly the same thing we're talking about. When we walk around and feeling guilty all the time, it's because we let circumstances on the outside define who we are. And therefore, if I made a mistake, I must be a bad person. And we walk around with guilt all the time. And in fact, what it leads to is not taking responsibility for it. Sounds opposite, but it is the way, right? Guilt often is just an escape. So everything outside is affecting me. I feel terribly guilty, so I feel very guilty, and then I feel even more guilty, and there's nothing about it, right? Because I'm just a bad person, and it's defined me. I can't control it. Looks like I can't change it, even though I want to, so I let it define me, and I just feel guilty. What are you doing about it? Nothing, just feeling guilty, right? Whereas good guilt, number one, comes in small measures. Good guilt doesn't control me, it doesn't define me. Good guilt means coming from within. Within means I want to grow. In order to grow, I need to sometimes feel uncomfortable, and that's okay. In order to grow, I need to face and confront my deficiencies and my shortcomings, knowing at the same time that it doesn't define who I am, that my intrinsic worth is still there, my intrinsic good is still there, but I do need to take responsibility for it. And good guilt means it's predicated on the foundation that we can grow and we can change. As right, that's an amazing thing. It's a very liberating thing. Good guilt means if I just feel a little bit uncomfortable where I am now, I'll be able to take the next step to the next place. Right. So that's good guilt. But bad guilt, but we're feeling ourselves feeling guilty all the time, as many of us Jews tend to do, then that's coming from without. That's a problem of an outside-in model. So again, these are three behaviors to be aware of, that if we're engaging in them a lot, it means that we're not quite shifting to the inside-out model, but we're still stuck in the outside-in model, letting the outside define who we are. Whereas if we try and stay away from those things, we try and get guilt under control, we try and stay away from anger, more into acceptance, we try and not be judgmental and turn the focus to what am I doing that's effective and productive and constructive and value-based in our day, those are behaviors, then will enhance and nurture the feeling of intrinsic worthiness and allowing us to work from inside out. You know, the first, in Jewish writing, there's something called the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch is essentially the code of Jewish law, right? So you have many different Jewish works. You have the Chumash, you have the Talmud, which is discussion of law, but then you have what's called the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch is the code of Jewish law. It's the manual. And of course, the Shulchan Aruch discusses everything from how to get up in the morning and how to pray and how to put a mezuzah and how to observe Shabbat and Kashrut and so on and so forth. And it's a string of law. That's what it is. It's just law after law after law. There's different versions of the Shulchan Aruch, and some are more discussion, some are less discussion, but essentially it's law. However, the very, very first instruction of the Shulchan Aruch, interestingly enough, the first instruction of the Code of Jewish Law, something that Rabbi Weinstein points out in the book, is actually not a legal, it's not a law altogether, it's more of an ethical thing. And it says, do not, it says, this is the very first thing. It says, do not be ashamed before those who laugh at you. In Hebrew, it's Al Yevosh Ripnei HaMaligim. Right? It's a very interesting thing. Here we have volumes of Jewish law. And it tells us that actually, which is God's laws, God's instructions, designed obviously to help us live a life of divine connection and meaning and purpose and so on and so forth. And the very, very first instruction is, do not be ashamed, do not be put off, so to speak, by those who laugh at you. In other words, the very, very first instruction of the Code of Jewish Law is saying, don't live an outside-in life. Don't be defined by those who are on the outside. Because if you're defined by those on the outside, the whole Shulchan Aruch doesn't start. You can't really observe it properly. I mean, you might go through the rituals, you might go through some of the technical, but the essence of what the Shulchan Aruch is about, you won't be able to apply if you are affected by those on the outside. Right? It's about building up that inner strength, about being living your life based on your values or your soul coming from the inside, and then the outside. There will be people who will scoff at you. There will always be people who interfere with you in many, many ways. It won't necessarily be easy. It might be painful. But that's why the Shulchan Aruch says, step one is live inside out. Don't be affected by those on the outside. Okay, so the last thing I just want to cover before we finish is I was just finishing the book and reading around the chapters and just preparing today's lesson, and I saw this chapter and I thought I have to talk about it because it's something that people always ask me after the Thursday, very often after the Thursday session. This is the question we get. And the question we get is, it's all very good for ourselves. What about the people who I live with? How about the people that live with that haven't come, right? You know, the people who really need to hear this, you know. So I'm reading this book, and here it is. It says, by now you might be thinking, okay, so I see how important it is for me to take responsibility for my behaviors. What about the people around me? How am I supposed to respond to their unhealthy behaviors, especially when I'm affected by them? It's a natural instinct to try and help other people and to get them to change and so on and so forth, right? It talks about couples and friends and so on. So there's no easy answer to this. I thought, wow, maybe he's going to tell me an answer that, you know, finally I'm going to have the answer to the people that ask me this question. No, nothing earth-shattering, but important principles. And it is difficult sometimes, right? And sometimes it even means, sadly, there are times in life where we walk away from relationships because of this. But that's after everything else has failed, right? What are the principles that we really have to bear in mind? So he talks about the principles of changing other people. Right? First principle is that we can't. Can't change others. Why? Because we don't control anything on the outside. That is the principle. It's very simple. We actually don't change people. What we do, however, right, and we'll get to that in a second, we can influence people. Very different. You can inspire people. We can create a catalyst for change that we can do. When can we do that? We go to the third thing, and that is when we change ourselves. Right? Now, what does that mean? You see, there's different principles in inspiring other people. So the baseline is we never change other people. I've told this to people in the past privately with regard to going into a relationship. That's a really important thing. People sometimes erroneously go into a relationship thinking that they'll change the other person. That is a fatal mistake. Right? Your baseline in going into any relationship is you're getting what you're getting, and they're not going to change. If you think it's not a problem, that's fine, but don't expect change. Everything else is a bonus, right? If you inspire change, if you create a culture of change, if people do change, wonderful. But don't think it's going to happen, right? The only people, of course, that we're supposed to not change but influence strongly is children. But they come as a clean slate, so that really is our responsibility. I mean, there's different kinds of clean slates, but they are moldable, if you know what I'm saying, right? So the principle is that we don't really change other people, we change ourselves, and by changing ourselves, we influence others. But what does that mean? Right? What does that mean? You see, there's a pasuk, there's a verse in the Torah that says, do not hate your brother in your heart. You shall surely reprimand your fellow, but do not bear sin on him. What do these three phrases actually mean? So here the pasuk is telling us we should reprimand other people, which is interesting. There is a mitzvah in the Torah to point to change people, seemingly, right? So if you look at this verse carefully, we find an amazing thing. And it goes back to the whole principle of living from within. Often when we try and even influence other people, we're unsuccessful, is because we're living an outside-in life. What that means is, we're starting from the outside, right? In other words, it's our problem that we have. We have a problem where we let the outside influence us. And sometimes the motivation to change other people is coming from how the other person is affecting me. Which once we start the way, it's already a problem, right? In other words, sometimes I need to influence that person because they're driving me mad. When that's the motivation to influence someone, we'll not influence them. Why? Because influencing others can actually only come post-acceptance. Because trying to influence someone because they're affecting me essentially means I'm trying to change them, not influence them. Which means I don't accept them, I don't have unconditional love for them, I don't accept the reality, and it needs to change. It needs to change. Why? Because it's bothering me. And then it won't work. It can never work. So here's the amazing breakdown of the pasuk. Don't hate your brother in your heart. In other words, the first rule to changing someone else, to influencing, inspiring, creating any sort of change into someone else is, you got to love them. Love them means you got unconditional love. You have to actually accept them. Respect them. Accept them completely. Accept the whole of them. Right? Then, the pasuk says, you can surely reprimand them. In other words, you can inspire change. Not to try to change other people doesn't mean you can never have a discussion with someone. It doesn't mean you can never point out to someone that perhaps what they're doing is unproductive or ineffective or hurtful. That doesn't matter. But it's stage two. Stage one means my intrinsic value, my welfare, my being doesn't depend on you. I am who I am because I am, and I have that soul and that intrinsic, infinite, permanent, eternal value. Who I am is not created by you. Who I am is created by me, and therefore I have no hate. Meaning we aspire not to have hate, right? From within, my job is to change myself. Part of that mission is to inspire a culture of change, which is absolutely our responsibility, coming from within. In other words, we do have a responsibility to change others in the sense that we have a responsibility to spread meaning and purpose. The Torah is very clear about that. We do not have the luxury of living alone, nor should we. We do not have the luxury of saying, I'm going to do what I do and let everyone do what they do. No, we actually are responsible for other people, interestingly enough. We get told we can't change other people, but yet we are told, no, we do have to create change. We have to create inspiration. We have to create influence, which is what good leaders do. They create influence. But it's a different kind of influence. Influence comes from within me. In other words, not because I need you to change because of me. I need to inspire you because that's part of who I am, part of my value system, part of my set of morals and values is that despite the fact that I fully accept you and I unconditionally love you, but for your good and for the world's good, I'm changing myself, I'm creating an example of change, and I verbalize it and communicate that and try to create a culture of change, a culture of inspiration. And then the Torah says, do not bear sin on him. Meaning, as Baba Shreva once explained, he says, don't blame him if he didn't listen, or her if he didn't listen, or if they didn't listen. Right? All it means is you have to try harder. You're not changing, it's nothing to do with them, it's got to do with you. So the Talmud tells us, Dvarim hayotzim min halev, things that come out, words that come from the heart, enter the heart. Now that's quite strong if you think about it, right? I mean, self-blame isn't a good idea either. In other words, it's not like feeling upset. What's meant by that is, if I tried to create inspiration and it didn't work, I'm not blaming myself, but if I'm going to put in more effort, it's not about getting upset with the other person. Because again, that's focusing on the outside. If I want to make it better, if I want to improve on the inspiration of change to other people, I need to try harder. I need to dig deeper within myself. I need to make sure that person feels that they're totally accepted, because most many people, put it that way, will change quicker is when we do have conversations with them and we do try to create a culture of change, if they feel understood and they feel accepted and they feel unconditionally accepted and unconditionally loved, much quicker for them to make a shift. Does it always work? No. But is it more effective? Absolutely. Right? Because when criticism, if we need to give criticism, and that sometimes is the case, or just trying to inspire someone to change, if they feel that as an attack on them, it's normally rejected. But if they feel fully respected, fully loved, fully unconditionally accepted, now, not, again, this is obviously a very, very complicated thing, and relationships are complicated things. We get that, right? And sometimes it just two people just don't match and just don't see eye to eye and just don't have the same value system. Yeah. Correct. 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 Correct.
You can try and salvage.
But the space is for us. In other words, the space is to dig within ourselves. Like, how am I saying this? Why do I want to change? How am I expressing it? How am I being understood? How am I being heard? Right? In other words, am I being heard just because I'm just broadcasting who I am because I'm busy with the outside? Or am I digging deeper and finding within myself, and that might take a space, it might take quite a bit of time sometimes, to find the love and to find acceptance and to come and that aspiration for change will come from a real deep place and from within, and then it's much more effective. It is complicated, but worth mentioning it. Sorry, what's that? Yeah, no, incredibly difficult. I mean, this is obviously, I mean, relationships are very, very complicated things, but we only have a fighting chance if this is the approach we take, right? In other words, this is a follow on of everything else we've said. It's about being liberated generally. I mean, this kind of life we talked about is really amazing, I mean, in our deal, right? It's consistent with the whole discussion we had on the book, The Choice, and lots of other discussions that we've had on self-esteem and so on and so forth. It's all the same thing, but just in different words. But it's really that point. It's the point of living a life from within. It's living a life where we acknowledge, and this is probably the most difficult part of this, if we can get over this, right? Going back to the very beginning. It's living a life acknowledging and accepting and coming to terms with and really connecting to the purity and the depth that's within each and every one of us, and that we have that thing, and it's working from that outside. Is it easy? Absolutely not. Is it liberating? Amazingly liberating. And as I said during the course of the discussion, it's not either or. In other words, it's a journey that we have to go on. Sometimes, some days, it's going to be more consistent with that. Some days, not. And that's so important to bear in mind. Because remember, we have the two forces in our subconscious. We have the ego and the soul. Sometimes the ego is just stronger. So it's hard. But that's okay. Each day is fresh. Each day we wake up, we say Modei Ani, we thank God for being alive, we thank God for giving our soul back to us, a fresh soul, a new day, time to try again. But the days that we can try and put this into practice just a little bit are very, very meaningful days and purposeful days. So thank you for listening. And I have the challenge of being embarrassed by Rita every year, so I'm going to have to, for fear of getting out of trouble,